So, welcome to another podcast of a series that I've called Tales from the Battlefields. It seems that the podcast is going from strength to strength with more followers linking up with me and more episodes being downloaded. This week has been another memorable week for me. I went over to the battlefields, to the Western Front, to the Somme and to Ypres with a friend of mine, John Foster. And this week I wasn't guiding. I finished guiding for this year. I was recceing some tours, family tours that have been booked for next year. And I also took the opportunity to meet up with some friends that live out on the battlefields, both English and Belgian people that live on the Somme and on the Ypres salient. And I recorded some podcasts with those people, which will be coming up either in the next few weeks or probably in the new year. Now, people often ask whether you see the same things when you go to the battlefields, and the answer is a definite no. Although we return to the same locations time and time again, obviously when we go with different families, we go to different parts of the battlefields, and every time you see the battlefield in a different way when you're looking at the historical evidence that you're following, the battalion diaries, published accounts. But also, it's the seasons. The seasons make a massive difference to any landscape, but in particular the Somme and the Ypres battlefields. And when we awoke one day last week, we looked out of the window. We were staying in the number 56 bed and breakfast on the Somme at La Boisselle. And usually when you look out of the window, the first thing you see in the morning is across Mash Valley, where so many British soldiers fell on the 1st of July 1916. And in the distance, on the horizon, you can see the Ovillers Military Cemetery. And beyond that, just about, you can see the Tietvelde Memorial. But this morning, you couldn't see any of that. In fact, you couldn't see the main D929 road between Albert and Bapaume, because there was a thick fog. And it really did. The fog didn't move on one of the days. It was there all day as we made our way up to Ypres. And it really did show us the battlefields in a completely different way and enabled me to take some incredible photographs. And to be honest with you, the battlefields looked deserted, quite sad, but extremely eerie. And it looked as though they were holding back secrets, that we were going out to discover what those secrets were. And that's what we did. There was one particular point where we were walking through the village of Poitiers, one of the highest points of the Somme battlefield. We were walking back through the village itself, having visited the site of the windmill and the tank memorial that's just beyond the village of Poitiers. And we noticed a track that I hadn't seen before going off to the right by the water tower. And we took that track and we turned left, and there was a few information boards which I think had probably been set up during the armistice period in 2014 to 2018. And as we walked down this track, in the back of a garden was an enormous German pillbox, which would have been built between 1914 and 1916. And it was something that I'd not seen before. So I took a photo of the pillbox, and I'll upload that to the podcast website at terrystours.co.uk. And I put it on social media, and it was incredible to see that even some of the most experienced guides that had been going to the battlefield for a lot longer than me had not seen this bunker before. And maybe it's because it was off the beaten track. It was down this little grass lane that wasn't even signposted. We just took it out of interest, really, to see what was there. And the Somme, once again, is giving up its secrets. It's an enormous structure, as they were, as the Germans had built those enormous. And, of course, underground, which we couldn't see, would have been the remains of the dugouts and the tunnels that the Germans had spent 2 years establishing on the high ground on the Somme battlefield. So what else did we discover during our few days on the Somme and up at Ypres? Well, we've said many times, and other battlefield guides has often said, that there's no such thing as a coincidence on the Somme battlefields. And a few weeks ago, I was staying once again at the number 56 bed and breakfast, which is in the village of La Boisselle. And I was looking out of the window, and in the distance, I could see the Gordon Dump Cemetery. Now, Gordon Dump is one of those cemeteries on the Somme battlefield that was initially established by men from the fighting units when the area had been captured in July 1916, but it was closed in September as the battle moved on, and originally there was just 95 soldiers there, mainly Australians, that had died in the August and the July of that year. Now, after the war, as with many of these original cemeteries, the cemetery itself was expanded. Many of the neighbouring cemeteries were closed down, and those graves were exhumed and concentrated into Gordon Dump. And there's now 1,676 Commonwealth servicemen from the First World War that are either buried or commemorated in this cemetery. But of those, an incredible 1,053 of the burials are unidentified. In addition to that, there's special memorials to 34 casualties that are either known or believed to be buried in that cemetery. And as I sat there a few weeks ago enjoying my morning tea, I wondered about those soldiers that are there. There's a Victoria Cross winner in there, the famous footballer. He's buried there that won the Victoria Cross at Contlemason, and his name was Donald Bell. But I was thinking mainly about those unidentified soldiers. Who were they? What was their story? No doubt they're commemorated on the Teat Vale Memorial. You know, what happened to their families? Did they ever get over here to see where their loved ones fallen? It's thoughts that often go through my mind when I have those few moments to myself when guiding on the battlefields. And then later on that day, I opened up my emails and I had an email from somebody who'd listened to the podcast, and they wanted to find out what had happened to two of their relatives that had died on the 1st of July 1916. And then I froze, really. A shiver went down my spine when I saw who those soldiers were, where they died, and where at least one of them was buried. Now, these two men were Robert and William Archibald, and they had emigrated at some stage to Western Australia to become farmers. But in December of 1914, they'd sailed back and sailed to Edinburgh to join up with the 16th Battalion of the Royal Scots. Their heritage was from Edinburgh, and it's the Edinburgh based Royal Scots that they decided to join in December of 1914. Now, Robert had married a lady called Isabel in Warminster in October 1915, and both brothers arrived on the Western Front with their battalion in January of 1916. And his brother William was unmarried, but they joined up together, and as we know, they went off to battle together. And they were one of the 19,000 men that were killed in action on that terrible first day, the 1st of July 1916, which we keep coming back to time and time again on this podcast, and we will continue to do so. So they both died. And then it occurred to me, the 16th Battalion of the Royal Scots, I knew that they'd gone into battle close by to Les Boisselles, just to the south of Les Boisselles. And then when I looked it up, I couldn't believe what I was seeing, because William Archibald was actually buried in Gordon Dump Cemetery, the cemetery that I could see from the bed and breakfast, and the cemetery and the men that I'd been thinking about just that morning. Now, his brother was reported missing. Robert was reported missing on that day, and he has no known grave, and he's remembered on the Teat Vale Memorial. So, obviously, we visited the cemetery, and we took a photo of William's grave. And then, as we know, there's over 1,000 unidentified burials in that cemetery, and a couple of graves away, there was three soldiers that had died on the 1st of July 1916, but there was no identification at all. There was no details of perhaps which regiment they were part of. So we don't know, but possibly, just maybe, that's where William's brother is lying to this day, when we'll never know the answer. But what an incredible coincidence that was. And I often feel, and I know a lot of other people do, that these soldiers are calling us in. They're pulling us. There's some sort of gravity that pulls us towards them. And I think that's more evidence of that. It's a theory that just goes on inside my head, inside my heart, really. I can't prove it. I can't disprove it. It's just a feeling that I have. And it's one of those things that draws me back to those battlefields time and time again. The relatives of the Archibald brothers lives in Scotland. And they were obviously delighted that I'd been able to find out what happened. We did a full research project and was able to explain to the family what had happened to those two brothers on that day. And we also discovered that they were, in fact, farmers whilst they were working in Australia. In fact, they were sheep farmers. The family thought that they were fruit farmers, but the records that we found online identified that were actually sheep farmers. And they actually owned property in Australia, so they were obviously quite wealthy, and it would have been a big issue for them to give up all that and to return to the United Kingdom to fight for their empire. There was a third brother called Bruce, and he'd emigrated to Canada, and he served throughout the war, and there's evidence that he was hospitalised several times. He was in hospital once with measles, he had a leg injury, and there's also evidence of shell shock as well on his record, but he survived the war. Now, the family wrote to me afterwards thanking me for visiting the graves. And the email says, and I quote, "What has been very special for me was knowing that someone has visited the graves and the memorial and thought about the boys, and it means a lot. And one day I'll hopefully make the journey myself." And I do hope that they do, and that it would be a real honour to show these people around the battlefields, not just where they're buried and commemorated, but actually to walk the battlefields, which is easy to do in that section of the Somme. There's plenty of country lanes, and they can walk exactly the place where their relatives died on that day, the 1st of July 1916. Now, on our way down to the Somme battlefields, we visited the town of Abbeville, which was located well behind the British lines during the First World War and was where many of the medical facilities were. There were casualty clearing stations there. And of course, it's where so many of those men died and are buried in the various, well, there's two main cemeteries in Abbeville, at the back of the civilian cemetery. And it was to one particular grave that I wanted to see. It was a man called Arthur Cox, and he was from Northampton. Now, Arthur originally joined his local regiment, but in June of 1917, he was in Abbeville, having been transferred to the Labour Corps. And as I say, they were nowhere near the action. So he wasn't in danger from the Germans, but he was in danger really from himself. Because that evening he borrowed a rifle from a mate, a comrade, a Private Hedgecock, and he went off rabbit shooting. He came back to the barracks and he handed the gun back to his mate, and he told Hedgecock that there was a single round in the gun. But he was wrong. And as Private Hedgecock removed what he thought was the only round, he closed the breech, but the gun went off and it wounded Arthur in the abdomen. Now, any wound in the abdomen is obviously very serious, and Hedgecock and another comrade, they managed to get Arthur to a hospital, a nearby hospital, and he was operated on, but he never regained consciousness and he died the following morning. And he's one of those soldiers that's buried in that cemetery in Abbeville. So we know that many soldiers died of their wounds, clearly, and they died of enemy fire, and many of them died in the 1918-1919 flu pandemic or epidemic. But we forget that sometimes soldiers died in accidents. Life, as we know, is very tenuous. Arthur must have thought that he was safe behind the lines, but he made a simple mistake, and that simple mistake cost him his life and no doubt had severe ramifications for his family back home. And of course, poor old Private Hedgecock, he wasn't to know, he didn't know that there was a round in that rifle, and I wonder how it affected him for the rest of his life. We'll never know, of course. Now, a couple of days before I went off to the battlefields, I was asked to do a presentation at a village called Wollaston, which is near Wellingborough in Northamptonshire. And I'd been there before, I'd talked to the people of Wollaston about the soldiers from the village that fell in the Great War. But on this occasion, they wanted to understand what had happened to two brothers called Braun that had gone from the village off to war and then come back. But they were no ordinary soldiers. They were conscientious objectors. They felt that it was wrong to take another man's life. But they were prepared to contribute to the war effort. There was something between 16 and 20,000 men that were conscientious objectors in the First World War. Many of those refused to contribute to the war effort at all and were put in prison, but not the Braun brothers. They were quite happy to join up, and they joined up with the Royal Army Medical Corps, and they became stretcher bearers, and both of them were awarded the Military Medal for bravery in bringing in soldiers whilst under fire during the First World War. Both of them survived, and they returned to the village, and indeed many of the people in the room knew one of those men because he'd been involved in the village community, and they were quite elderly and they remembered him before he died in the 1960s. But then I surprised the people of Wollaston by explaining to them that there was a third conscientious objector that had gone off with the two Braun brothers. So he was obviously a mate. The newspaper article confirmed that all three of them had gone off together. and his name was William Kilsby, and he'd also been awarded the Military Medal for Bravery. But he wasn't with the Braun brothers. He'd gone off to Mesopotamia, what we now call Iraq, and that's where he served during the First World War. He came back to Wollaston, and he died in 1974. And I was quite happy to tell that story and thought that was the end of it. But I could see that some of the people in the audience, their eyebrows were raised when I mentioned William's name, William Kilsby. And when I finished talking, I was stunned into silence, which, as people know, doesn't happen very often with me. And to be honest, I had to sit down because I was telling this story in the room above the Methodist chapel in the village of Wollaston. And directly below my feet in the chapel below, they took me downstairs and showed me a photograph of William, who'd served also in the Home Guard in the Second World War. And there in a frame was his medals, including the Military Medal, and a photograph of him as well. So the man that I was going to be talking about was well known in the village. He'd obviously worshipped at the chapel that I was talking in. And the villagers didn't know that I was going to talk about him. And the other thing they didn't know was that he was a conscientious objector. And I really couldn't believe it. Once again, similar to all these other stories that I've told, that soldier was bringing us in, wasn't he? He wanted his story to be told, hopefully. And there I was, telling his story without knowing that just a few yards away beneath my feet was his military medal that I'd just been talking about. Incredible, really. And the final story that I'd like to tell on this week's podcast is an incredible story, really, of an Irishman whose name I will attempt to pronounce. It was Private Samuel McElf Fatrick, and he was with the 11th Battalion of the Royal Inniskillen Fusiliers, and he was another one of those men that was killed on the first day of July 1916, aged 35. And it's another one of those men whose stories I researched for his family. And I discovered that in 1911, on the census of 1911, he was married to a lady called Hessie, and they had three children. And he'd been born and was living in Londonderry in Northern Ireland. Samuel arrived on the Western Front in October 1915 with his battalion. The 11th Battalion of the Royal Inniskillen Fusiliers were formed at Omagh in 1914. And the battalion diary tells us that they suffered horrendous casualties on that day, the first day of the Battle of the Somme. They went into battle with 38 officers and 991 other ranks. But by the end of the day, as they attempted to enter the German fortified Schraben Redoubt, close to where the Ulster Tower now stands, they'd suffered round about 600 casualties. 600 out of a fighting strength of 900. An incredible casualty list. And amongst the dead that day, and whose body was never found, was our Samuel that I'd been researching. Not an unusual story up to now. It's a story that could be told, nearly 20,000 times on that day. But what was different about this man was a poem that his wife, his widow Hessie, later wrote about him, and it was published in the local paper, not just on when he died, but on every single year on the anniversary of his death. And now I'm going to attempt to read that poem. It says, "My noble husband lies in his blood-soaked garments through. In a nameless grave, unknown, lies the heart that beat so true. He sank, faint and weary, among the famous brave, and they laid him sad and lonely, all in his lonely grave. No dear one was near him to mark his soft replies. No one was near him to close his soft dark eyes. No stone marks the grave where my husband lies so lone, in a nameless grave unknown, with his blood-soaked garments through. No more bugle will call our darling one. Rest, noble soldier, all in your grave unknown. But we will know you, we will find you among the good and true. Then you will wear a robe of white for your blood-soaked garments through. Daddy, dear Daddy, good night, good night." It's actually really difficult to read that without becoming emotional. And I read it and thought of him when I found his name on the Teepvale Memorial, which is just a few hundred yards from where he died. And she wrote that poem with the knowledge that he died bravely. because I've got a copy of a letter here that one of his comrades wrote back to Hesse. And she said, and I quote from that letter, that Samuel had his legs blown off, but he just lit a pipe and sat down in the shell hole to die, and he belonged to the 11th Battalion. So that's enough of listening to my stories that I've uncovered in the last couple of weeks. Let's listen to somebody else, shall we? A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Megan Kelleher, who works for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. And Megan talked to me about her new job with the Commonwealth War Graves Commission Foundation, the charity arm of the commission. And she'd also got some incredible stories that she'd found while she was researching her PhD. And she shared those stories with us on the podcast. So, hello, Megan. You're the first person to come on to Tales from the Battlefields twice, because we recorded a podcast back in April in the sunshine of the spring. And I know a lot's happened to you since then with your new job. You got a new job. So you were a public engagement coordinator for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission until a couple of weeks ago. What are you doing now?
Yeah, and what an honour to be back on this wonderful podcast. Thank you for having me again, Terry. So I'm now doing the role of the Events and Challenge Fundraising Officer for the charitable arm of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, which is called the Commonwealth War Graves Foundation, which, of course, last time we talked about the wonderful volunteers that we have, and you're one of them, Terry. And so that's how those projects are funded, through the charitable arm there. So my job is very similar to what it was with the public engagement coordinator role. It's to raise income through programs of fundraising, events and challenges. So like the Walking Our War Graves that they did for the Western Front and for the Normandy campaign. And it also includes things like the upcoming carol service, which at the time of recording, we're about 3 weeks out from the carol service, which is being held at the Guards Chapel.
Oh, right. They did this last year, didn't they?
Yeah, unfortunately, it got cancelled last year due to COVID. But yeah, this year is going ahead at the time of recording.
Yeah. And when is that? What date is that?
That's Thursday, the 8th of December.
Yeah. Okay. This is the Guards Chapel next to Wellington Barracks.
Yes, it is. And it looks like it's going to be a really wonderful evening. So I started my new job on the Monday. We're recording on the Saturday. Yeah. So I've been in post for a full week now.
Have you achieved lots in your first week?
I'd like to say I have. It's been really nice to talk to so many people and kind of see what's going on through that element, because obviously I've been working with the charity through the role of public engagement coordinator, but it's nice to see it from a different angle and see the types of things that go on behind the scenes to organise their events as well. So I'm really looking forward to it.
But the bit that was really interesting to me, you said you've got to raise funds for the foundation, because the foundation is the charitable arm of the commission. The commission is funded itself by the UK government and other Commonwealth governments. But what does the foundation do that's different to the main part of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission?
So it's the way that we help to highlight the work of the CWGC through engaging new audiences and finding those new ways to involve the whole community in our work. So that can be the education and outreach side of things that the public engagement team help with to organise and run. Also the volunteer activity, arts and heritage projects, local research, and then just general partnership working. So, for example, Terry, I'm aware that you are one of our star volunteers.
Well,
you do so a number of the projects. There are so many, but there are so many different projects too. So things like the McRobert Trust Speakers and Tour Guides Programme, which of course you are one of down in Northampton, Terry. Yeah. So that's connecting schools and colleges, universities and other groups in that history and heritage that the Commission has, and enabling us to share those stories of the people that they commemorate. And then we have the Eyes on Hands-On project, which allows volunteers to reconnect with history and heritage of the two world wars on their doorstep. And then we have the Guides Programme, which is how I started out working for the Commission, which is an amazing opportunity for young people to work at some of the most iconic sites for remembrance along the former Western Front. Yeah. And then, of course, the Royal Air Force Air Cadets project, where cadets have been discovering some of the stories of the over 58,000 Air Force's personnel who are buried or commemorated in the UK, which is one of those projects that is very dear to my heart to learn about. So it's wonderful to have so many different things that are going on that we can engage with.
It seems as though this new role fits you perfectly then, doesn't it?
Yeah,
And
definitely.
the guards chapel is fascinating because a number of the men were killed there, weren't they? Was it a doodle bug memory that hit them?
I believe so, yeah. I'm not sure of the exact story, but I think so. Something happened there,
We'll have
didn't
to look
it?
that up and put that in the extras bit of the podcast, because I know it does have a and there's a memorial outside, isn't there? I remember going and seeing the memorial outside, and so many of them were killed in there. And that was a Christmas service, wasn't it? They were at a Christmas service when that happened.
Cool.
So, apart from this, then, the last few months you've been doing your PhD, finishing off your PhD, and it was that really wanted to talk about today, and the subject of that. What has that been about then?
So my PhD has been looking at the commemoration and care of First World War dead buried in the United Kingdom by the Imperial, later known as Commonwealth War Graves Commission. So highlighting how those sites of memory over here both conform to and contrast with the sites overseas, but also some of the nuances that can be found here. And I think when I started the project, I'm sure this is a story that so many researchers find. You think you're going to find one answer, or you're just looking for a specific thing, which was to see that comparison. And I ended up finding these stories of unique situations and also challenging my own perception, really, of remembrance in Britain and how people commemorated those who were buried closer to home and how that's adapted over time.
For a start, how many cemeteries and burials are there and memorials in the UK? Because a lot of people don't realise this, do they?
Yeah, and this is something that I don't think I even realised. So I'm including figures here for across the United Kingdom and the island of Ireland. But there are more than 306,000 commemorations across the United Kingdom and the island of Ireland that are cared for at over 13,000 locations. Now, of which of those, approximately 170,000 are burials, and over 37,000 of those are marked with private markers. So they're the ones that would have been chosen by families in lieu of a standard commission headstone. And this means that there's actually the second highest concentration of commemorations in the United Kingdom and the island of Ireland. So France has the most commemorations, and then this the United Kingdom and Ireland, and then it's Belgium. So it's really interesting that people don't necessarily connect it to that
No,
heritage.
that's right. So we've got more commemorations and burials in the UK and Ireland than what there are in Belgium.
Yes,
That's
yeah.
right, isn't it? Wow, that is incredible, isn't it? And why would a soldier or an airman or a sailor have a burial or commemoration in England rather than where they fell? Because this crops up a lot on the tours. People thought that everyone is buried abroad. What? How did they? Were they repatriated their bodies back to the UK?
So there are always more than one reason for why people come back over here. I think the most common one that we probably are familiar with through popular culture is people dying of sickness or disease in a military hospital after being repatriated back to the UK for treatment. So those wonderful military hospitals that we know through our local history. However, some people died during training or other accidents while they were in service. And some died due to the enemy action over the United Kingdom and Ireland, so things like air raids and that sort of thing. And then, in addition to that, some of them are killed in action in the air or at sea, and their remains are later washed ashore. So then it's a case of commemorating them here, which is particularly something that happens with the Second World War, those latter two points. But there are cases in the First World War as well, of course.
And so if a relative had been killed abroad, could the family then ask and for the body to be repatriated like they did in Germany and America?
So prior to 1915, there wasn't a policy in place for to ban repatriation. But in 1915, at the start of 1915, there was a policy that was brought in on the grounds of both hygiene and logistic purposes to not repatriate remains, which is why we have those wonderful sites of memory overseas. And we can see that today. And obviously, at the time, there are lots of inquiries files that talk about why they didn't choose to do that, how could they not choose to do that, especially once the war's ended, and particularly, like you say, when the US can repatriate them and they're saying that it's due to hygiene reasons and things like that. However, as with anything, there are
Always an
always
exception, isn't
exceptions to
there?
the
Always
rule.
exceptions,
So the most famous one, of course, is William Ewart Gladstone's
Gladstone.
grandson was repatriated.
Gladstone was a prime minister, famous prime minister.
Yes, yeah,
Yep.
and he was repatriated, and I believe he's buried near to the family seat in North Wales. But that was very controversial at the time. But there are other cases. Most of them happened illegally,
Yep.
and are completely separate to the commission's work, because obviously this is prior to their existence.
So that's happened. The illegal ones have happened after 1915, when
Yes.
wealthy families have made arrangements for bodies to be exhumed from where they fell on the Western Front and shipped home. Some of them, I understand, got intercepted at ports before they
Yes.
managed to get across the channel. But of course, isn't this also one of the reasons why they stopped doing this? Because the idea was, through the Commission's founding principles, that all the dead would be treated equally. And if they allowed families to bring their dead home, it would be the rich families that were able to do that. And of course, the poor families wouldn't be able to do that. So that was another one of the reasons, was it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's where it came through.
Yeah.
And it really highlights that importance of the founding principles that were there of that equality in death. Because if we look at those sites of memory today, we can see the importance and the impact that they have, particularly when we're giving tours of these sites and that sort of thing. And you're able to see a group of people who have all died on the same day, whether that's a commanding officer and his men, or whether that's a group of friends that joined up together. And I think it's a really wonderful way of us looking at it to see it in that physical format. But obviously, when we're looking at the 1920s, there's no real comparison of what it could look like. And so people are getting nervous. And like you say, it would have been more affluent families who are more likely to be able to fund those costs of repatriation if it was done privately. And so that would have therefore caused that inequality that we see with previous earlier conflicts and things like that. A lot of discussion is things like the fields of Waterloo and 19th century battles that the British military are involved in, that can give you a comparison of how that could have potentially looked.
The guys that are buried, you mentioned 307,000, was it? 307,000 memorials and burials. Not all of those are graves, are they?
No, so
You
some of
need
them are
help.
names on memorials to the missing. So, for example, a lot of naval casualties are commemorated in the UK at their main manning ports. So
Yeah.
that's Portsmouth, Plymouth, and Chatham.
Yeah.
But you, of course, also have, for example, for the Second World War, the Runnymede Air Force's Memorial and things like that. You may also find that there are alternative commemorations in the commission sense, and not the ones that are on private memorials, which I'll explain in a second.
Yeah.
But cases where those remains have been lost and they're unknown soldiers, for example, and lost in the sense that they were buried at sea and that sort of thing in action,
Yeah.
and that sort of thing. But also, in addition to that, the complication then comes in with these private memorials.
Yes.
So private memorials are family owned graves.
Yep.
Sometimes it's a grave for the entire family to be buried in.
Yeah.
So there may be multiple names on it. And they don't necessarily look like a standard commission headstone because they'd been chosen by those families.
And why would the family do that then? I mean, they'd have been offered a Portland headstone by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. They'd have been sent a form to complete, and the family, in so many occasions, have chosen to have their own. I know that you mentioned some of them are buried within plots, but are there any other reasons why they would choose to have their own private memorial?
Yeah, so a lot of the time it's simply that they've paid for that already prior to the commission's existence and formalisation of taking on the maintenance and care for these graves. So they've already put in a curb or a grave marker around that grave to highlight those, and then they're being told that they could have this option. And it could be as well that the names of other relatives from earlier or later dates between that time period have since been added to it. So they want them as part of that family memorial rather than something separate. And again, it's that case of there's no precedent there for what this will look like within a plot.
No. Because they couldn't do that, could they? If the soldier had been killed and buried on the battlefields, then they would have no choice. It would have to be a Portland headstone. But straight away, I can think of an exception. That's at Highley Station Cemetery. There's still a private memorial there in the middle of the cemetery that sticks out and looks very different to all the others. There's always an exception, isn't there?
Yes, yeah, definitely. And also, even with the stone types as well. So, more than 30 different types of stone are used by the commission. Of course, we've got Portland's, which is that cream white headstone that we're most familiar with. But for example, where we are in the Midlands, the type of headstone that would be used is a locally quarried stone, which is called Stancliff, which
We
is that
got that here.
brownish
in Northampton, Toast the Road, there's a load of them there, but they're not as nice as the next in the First World War plot. We've got that type of stone, and then next to it, the Second World War plot of the new Portland headstones, and they, especially in the poor weather, they look much nicer.
Yeah, and it's a case of those sort of differences for different people. And again, at the time, they're working with local communities, and sometimes they're using those stones because they are working with local contractors. And that sort of thing. So again, in Scotland, you'll see the granite headstones or slate headstones down in the southwest. And it's employing those local people to commemorate them. And I quite like the Stancliffe ones personally, but I know a lot of people might not like them. It's all personal preferences.
It's only in the bad weather. Like last week, we were up there and it was raining, and they look quite sad in the rain. But in the summer, it looked much nicer.
Yeah, it's always catching a cemetery on a good day. You like them in a sunny day, don't you?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So looking at these, we talked about this before, particularly interested in the family inscriptions on these headstones. And I know you've done a lot of work on this. For a start, before we go into that, how would the family get to have a family inscription? Because I thought all these headstones were the same.
So the family inscription was something that was added to because there was that discussion among members of the public, particularly the bereaved, that they didn't get the choice that they would have done had their loved one died at home as a civilian, for example. Yeah. And so there was this option to put in a personal inscription. And initially it did cost some money. And you had to have a certain amount of letters as a maximum.
Yeah.
So you couldn't have a whole headstone worth of text.
Yeah, six characters, wasn't it, to start with?
Yes,
including spaces.
Yes.
Yeah.
So most of the most common, one of the most common personal inscriptions that are on commissioned headstones are simply RIP.
Yeah.
And it could be written in any language, but I should just clarify at this point, even though there was initially that financial cost, which was very quickly scrapped when they realised it went against those policies of equality, no one was being hounded for that money.
They didn't collect the money. No.
But it was that theory alone might have put some people off, which is why by the Second World War, you'll see a lot more personal inscriptions, generally speaking, because by that time it was completely free.
And more characters as well. They allowed more characters in the Second World War, didn't they?
What did they?
On the headstones, they're much longer. I think it's 100. I have to check this. I think it's something like 120 characters. And the Australians, they didn't. The Aussies never agree with us, do they?
New Zealanders that didn't agree to it.
They banned it, didn't they? New Zealand.
Yeah, so the Canadians and the Australians said that they would supplement it through their funding.
Yeah.
And then for the New Zealanders, it was a case of they said from the start that. Again, it will go against that policy of equality.
Yeah.
We should also say at this point that, again, there are exceptions to that rule.
Yeah.
But also on top of that, when we're talking about nationality, we're talking about the country of service.
Yes.
So it could be you've got a New Zealander serving with the British forces who technically has that. So, it always adds that nuance.
Oh, yeah, otherwise someone's going to say, what about this one?
Yeah, absolutely.
You've been there before, haven't you?
Definitely. But they are some really poignant personal inscriptions. And the thing that I've noticed through inscriptions in the UK is you tend to find that they are sometimes slightly more personal in the sense of talking about family members who are missing them and that sort of thing. And particularly when we come around to the Second World War. Whereas, of course, when you're talking about battlefield cemeteries that are potentially geographically quite far away, there's a lot of conversation generally about them missing them from afar.
Yes, of course.
And that sort of thing.
Yeah, so far away and still loved and that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really quite nice to see those comparisons. But there are those similarities in the sense of religious inscriptions are quite popular. Mm. Quotes from key literature, so things like Shakespeare and that sort of stuff are quite popular. RIP is, that classic one. Psalms and hymns are also quite commonplace. And it's those sorts of things that come up quite often, both on the battlefields and at home. So it really is quite nice to see those connections there.
So have you got some good examples? This is what I've been looking forward to. I always love to, because they tell us, obviously if it's a religious inscription, it tells us the family was religious, but sometimes the inscriptions tell us a bit about the soldier and about the family, don't they? And, and I always start, when I go to any cemetery, wherever it is, I always start from the bottom and work my way up.
Me too. I'm exactly the same because I find that reading these personal inscriptions can often be the most poignant way to get interested in these topics. If you haven't been to a site before and you're feeling a little bit overwhelmed, In the UK, around 90% of the sites that have burials in have 10 or less graves, but you are wandering around a cemetery effectively, or you are, or a churchyard. And so it can be quite overwhelming being in a space with a lot of grief and a lot of emotion. So I find by focusing in on those personal inscriptions, you get to connect a bit more to those families, and enable yourself to kind of focus in on it without it becoming too overwhelming and a bit too much to handle in one go.
And have you got some examples of some inscriptions there in your files? I'm
I
sure.
do. And what I picked is I picked ones from the inquiries file. So I'll just briefly explain what I mean by inquiries or e-files, because this makes up one of the chapters that I looked at, which was more emotional responses to the commission's work in the UK. And I should say that there was slight more, a little bit more difficulty in the UK because some families did own the grave rights. So you're having to have conversations with a family that you wouldn't necessarily have had overseas to have that moral obligation to say, we'd like to do this type thing. So the inquiries files that I looked at are from relatives who have loved ones buried near-ish to them in most cases. And there's lots of interesting stories. They are free to download. There's about 2,000 files that were released in April of 2020. About 50 of them were UK specific, and they made up this chapter. So that's why I wanted to highlight them here.
And they're within the archive section of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website.
Yes, they are. And this was perfect because, of course, we're in the height of lockdown at this point, and I just started my PhD, was about to go to the archives, and then I could access documents for free
Online,
online and enjoy them from the comfort of my own home and staying
lockdown was great, wasn't it? I enjoyed
safe. So this one I've picked for you, Terry, because I know that you like Norfolk and it's very dear to your heart. I know Norfolk is a massive county, by the way, before I continue with it. So the first one I wanted to talk about was Saddler Edgar Atherton, sorry, who was serving with the Royal Field Artillery at the time of his death. So in 1956, his widow had written to the commission talking about a recent visit to her husband's grave. And I thought that this was particularly interesting because when we think of travel, we think it must have been so difficult to go to France and Belgium and other battlefields and things like that. But families also moved around the country, or even within counties, and that could be quite a significant journey. So this lady said that during a recent visit to her late husband's grave, she had travelled from Great Yarmouth to Fakenham, which doesn't sound too far in terms of comparison to different countries, but
Probably
still quite
40
a
or 50
distance.
miles, is it? Something like that. Yeah.
Which we think at the time, they're not necessarily having fast enough
No.
cars to
And it's
go there.
cross-country as well, so there wouldn't have been any easy way to do that by train.
Exactly. So she's made this pilgrimage to his grave, which is still in the same county, but quite a journey. And she stopped to pay her respects at his final resting place. But when she got there, she couldn't actually locate where her late husband's grave was. So she went to the local town and spoke to a local man who went back to the site with her. And eventually they were both able to successfully locate the grave. But the helper at the site had said that the wooden cross, which had been put on Saddler Atherton's grave, had rotted away and then had been taken away. But it's unclear whether that wooden cross was a temporary marker that had been installed by the commission, or whether it was a permanent marker that she had chosen in lieu of a commission headstone, and funded by the family. So it's unclear about that in those letters. They had since placed a curb around the grave, the family, but that had now been covered by grass and a vase had been taken off. So again, what was quite commonplace in English cemeteries at this time was to have a curb around it or a mound to stop people walking over your grave. Whereas commission sites, you tend to find a flat lawn surface, and that sort of thing. But regardless, it had caused quite a lot of distress for her to find that effectively his grave wasn't being
Sure, it
marked.
would be, yeah.
And she found people walking over her late husband's grave as well, which was quite a traumatic experience for her by all accounts in this letter. So the area superintendent for the commission went out to assess the grave, and he found that the grave had been privately marked, but it had since fallen into neglect, as we see in many churchyards for graves from Victorian times. And that sort of thing, it would have looked something like that. But what he also found, which is quite commonplace for a number of privately marked graves, is that it actually hadn't been included in the maintenance agreement for the site, which he rectified on the spot with the cemetery owners. But again, they couldn't do that unless the families gave them permission.
Mm.
So the commission said to the widow that they couldn't look after the grave as it was because it wasn't in within their policies of
No.
that thing. But they offered to mark the grave with a standard commission headstone. But they also said they wouldn't assume responsibility for the curb and ask for that to be removed or not be responsible for the flint that was requested to cover that grave. And they offered her a personal inscription and said, you know, it's 66 characters, that sort of
Yep.
thing.
Yeah.
And she went with quietly remembered with thought sincere as
Oh.
his inscription.
That's very subtle as well, isn't it? Very
Yeah.
subtle.
And it's
Wow.
quite sweet because I think if I remember rightly in those letters, it appears that she had since remarried.
Oh,
So when we
right.
consider that context of him
Yeah.
quietly being remembered,
Yeah.
it's highlighting that he's not forgotten from her
Although she's
heart.
moved on with a new man, new husband, quietly
Yeah.
remembering the man that was perhaps her first love.
Exactly. And that
Wow.
was quite poignant to read. But the other one I wanted to highlight is an Australian at a slightly larger site. And he doesn't have a personal inscription, but what struck me with this particular story was the letter that was received by the commission from his relatives. So he is Sergeant Bootle of the Australian Imperial Force.
Yeah.
In 1956, again, it was found by the commission staff that while they were conducting maintenance at Oxford Botley Cemetery, which is quite a large site,
Yeah, just by the A34. As you go down, just thinking people who don't know, Botley Cemetery, I think there's over 1,000 there, isn't there? And it's as you go down towards Oxford, down the A34, it's just on the left-hand side. And if people can pass that, you can't see it from the road. There's a sign. If people do go there, it's worth stopping off. It's a beautiful place. And this is where this Australian is buried.
Yes, he is there. And the Commission's works team noticed that again, his grave had fallen into disrepair. It was a private memorial.
So
And
this is
again,
in
thinking,
1956, and
yes, so barely 40 years.
but he died in the First World War, this
Yes.
chap. So 40 odd years later.
Yes, we're seeing that, you know, natural decay that happens within a cemetery in terms of the headstones and that sort of thing if they're not being maintained. But so what they did was they spoke to the superintendent of the site because again it is part of a municipal cemetery where there is a bit of
Yes.
land. And the superintendent noted that he'd actually spoken to the sister of Sergeant Bootle and she'd said similar. So when she'd recently visited the site as part of a pilgrimage to the UK,
Yeah.
she'd asked for an approximate price of renovation. And the superintendent had been very honest and said it would be quite expensive, but you might want to speak to the commission because where he's a war casualty, you might get a headstone for free. And she'd shown a real interest in this. She'd never heard of the organisation before, again, remembering at this time that they are still a relatively new organisation. And he kept a letter from her as a forwarding address should someone come in and ask about it.
Yeah.
So this is all sort of serendipitous type things that happened. So they wrote to the sister offering to write a personal inscription on the headstone, and
Okay.
she politely declined that, which again, some relatives didn't want an
No,
inscription.
perhaps couldn't think of one. You know, it's so emotional and
Exactly.
the words just won't come sometimes.
Precisely, and we've got to consider that the sister's coming over from Australia, so she might have only just seen this headstone for the first time,
Over
or
Mary.
only just properly processed that grief and that sort of thing. So she might not have, like you said, been able to think of something at the time. But what was particularly lovely about this story was within a matter of months, they'd erected the new headstone because they wanted to make sure that the sister got to see the new grave before she
Oh,
returned
she
to
went home.
Australia.
Oh, wow. That's brilliant.
And again, working with local contractors, so potentially veterans themselves,
Yeah.
and that sort of thing, and also enabling the local economy to flourish through those partnerships.
Yeah.
And the letter that they received via the Australian Embassy from the sister said, please convey to the area superintendent my thanks. I will remember it as one more to the list of courtesies I have received since I arrived in England, and I do appreciate it.
That just shows again the power. People say, "Oh, the Australians and the British don't get on." This is an example that we do get on. They're our cousins, and that is so powerful, isn't it? She's come all the way around the world to see him. She's probably then felt quite upset and emotional, seeing that the mess that the grave was in. It's been put right, and what it's given them to her when she's gone back to Australia is that closure, isn't it, that we talk about so
Yeah.
often. Wow.
Exactly. And it's one of those things that we can again compare to battlefield cemeteries where people were able to visit those for the first time. So there is a lot of overlap there. So there are those unique situations that happen in Britain, but also there is that connection. There's not a complete disconnect of an us versus them attitude. It's very much an overlap, and a sort
It
of a
is.
sibling relationship.
Yeah, definitely. And that was his sister, was it, did you say?
Yes.
The soldier's sister, right? So she's got maybe come on her own without her parents and maybe gone back and explained it all to them. Huh. Although if they were still alive, they probably wouldn't have been alive all those years later, would they? But
Potentially, and we don't know whether I haven't necessarily looked into the
no.
genealogy in terms of whether it was an older sibling, a younger sibling, and
That's
that
another
sort of thing.
PhD then, that is. What happened to the relatives?
Yeah, if anyone wants to do another
No, that's for
PhD.
you.
But yeah, thank you so much for letting me come on the podcast again, Terry. And it's been really lovely to share more stories. I will be sharing my PhD when I can, but I'm sure, as some people can appreciate with the system, it takes a little bit of time before I'm allowed to release all of my findings. But once I do, I will make sure to let you know, and we can add that to the show notes and things.
Brilliant. Yes, that would be really good. And thank you once again for coming on, and really good luck with your new job. And
Thank
I
you.
know you still got to go through some more hurdles before you become a doctor, and I'm sure that will go well.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Megan.
So that's it for this week. Thank you again for tuning in to my podcast, Tales from the Battlefields. And I've got a few ideas for the next podcast, which will come out before Christmas. Got a couple of things I've recorded recently, but I haven't made up my mind which one to use or which ones to save for the new year. So look out for that when it comes out in a couple of weeks. And as usual, I wanted to finish by playing the last post in tribute to all of the soldiers, those that survived and those that died in the war that we talked about on this podcast.